Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Justin McAfee. He produced his first short film, Great Basin Water Protectors, about an indigenous people's prayer run on a water pipeline that threatened a large area of rural Nevada. He's currently working on a film series, Desert Apocalypse, about the assault on the Mojave and Great Basin in Nevada, one of the largest intact ecosystems in the lower 48 states. He resides in Nuwuvi-occupied southern Paiute lands in southern Nevada. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Thanks for having me, Derek.
So can we start with just an introduction to the Mojave and Great Basin? And I mentioned before we started that those seem like two different communities to me. I lived in Nevada for a few years, and the Great Basin felt different than the Mojave, but you had some really interesting things to say in response to me saying that.
Yeah, and I think they definitely are, you know, distinct ecosystems. We talk about in the Great Basin, there is the sagebrush steppe, and it's definitely a cooler environment. And the Mojave Desert, you know, south of there, it's warmer and drier. And you see a change in the biology, of course. You see, yucca and Joshua trees and things like that. A lot of the animal life, though, goes back and forth. There's definitely a transition zone between the two. And they certainly both occupy Nevada. And, you know, nature doesn't have lines where you step over and you go from one thing to the other. So it's just really part of a larger geographic area called Basin and Range, which goes down into the deserts in Mexico as well. That's why Basin and Range Watch, which is a group that I've worked with, they call themselves Basin and Range Watch because these things are connected and they are, they're dry. So the kind of human development that has occurred elsewhere in the country has not occurred here. That's changing, obviously with Las Vegas growing and Reno growing and other places. But because of that dryness, like many other places in the world that are kind of harsh environments, boreal forests, tundras, things like that, deserts are places that haven't been destroyed. That's what's left, actually, in the world that hasn't been completely ran over by human development.
And you've said that there is a long history. I mean, even though it's relatively intact, there is still a long history of environmental destruction in the region. Can you give us a quick overview?
Yeah, I say that with a caveat because it's comparably, maybe it's like 98% of areas in, the Midwest have been just, by agriculture or other human development has been changed and altered by humans, whereas it might be less here. There is still huge areas where you can go out there and there might be a dirt road and that's it, or maybe a power line along the dirt road. But in terms of the history of Nevada, it does have a long history of starting with mining. When it became a state in 1860, the mining laws, the laws that were put into even the Constitution were very favorable to mining. I mean, they basically ran the place. It was about, securing those minerals for the Union when the Civil War was happening. That's why it's called the Battleborn State. And so ever since then, it's just been written into the foundation of law that mining doesn't get taxed, that they just basically have their way. And with the federal government, it's the same thing. There's a mining law that exempts them from all sorts of processes as they apply for, like up in Thacker Pass, where they're doing lithium mining. They just are able to fast track. And the BLM, even though there's lots of great places that are BLM land, the BLM's job really is to secure resources for mining and other capital interests like that. And then, of course, you have the rangelands. You have grazing that has destroyed lots of Nevada. Some of that's being recovered, like in southern Nevada, there's lots of areas. There was a huge cattle ranch down south of Las Vegas near Searchlight called Walking Box Ranch, and I think a couple of Hollywood movie stars had a ranch there. And anyway, that has since, I mean, there's just not enough water. The water's dried up, the wells have dried up, so they ended grazing down there, and some of that habitat has recovered over time. And I think that could be the case elsewhere, but you know, the further north you go, the more ranching there still is. And there is, of course, this huge area in the middle of Nevada where they tested nuclear weapons. They are still, you know, doing military activity out there with the Air Force. It's called the test range or the bombing range. That's all. That's the test. I mean, it's an enormous area. And in some ways, maybe it's good that that hasn't been touched by other human activity. And so you go out there and that might be some of the most untouched areas in Nevada. But there's also, there was the MX missile where they wanted to, you know, go throughout Nevada and hide missiles underground, missile silos. and then, of course, there is the storage of nuclear waste at Yucca Mountain, which is basically in southern Nevada in the test range. So that was that's been a huge topic of political interest in the last couple of decades. They've been trying to store the nation's nuclear waste there.
So before we move on to modern assaults on the region, I want to take you back to that ranch, the Walking Box Ranch. And there are some native communities that can recover very quickly. Peat bog, my understanding is that once you stop draining it and reintroduce a few plants, it does recover very quickly. And forests can start to recover, but it will take 1,000 years to even go one time through the nutrient cycle, because, you know, a tree has to grow for 500 years, fall over, and decay for the next 500. And grasslands in the Midwest, like, I remember reading Dick Manning's book on prairies, that grasslands can start to recover pretty quickly. What's the story for desert recovery? It would seem that with the, you haven't talked about the soil crusts. With the soil crusts and with the lack of water, it seems that it would take a long time for the desert to recover from some sort of serious ecological trauma. Is that true, or can it recover fairly quickly?
So I think it depends. And this is not my area of expertise per se, but I will say what I know, which is that I know there's still invasive grasses, like cheatgrass and different kinds of grasses like that were for the cattle, and that's still around. That can cause fires. You know, we saw the FEMA dome fire in the Mojave Preserve, which is just south of Nevada in California, and there was a million Joshua trees that burnt there. And that's got to be, you know, climate change. It's got to be, I think, the inclusion of invasive species as well. So when I say recover, I mean, it looks more natural than I think it did. It doesn't look as denuded, but yeah, it may not be what it was. And to your point about the soils, I'm going to talk about the Yellow Pine Solar Project in a little while, but the soils there, I've been told, are 100,000 years old. So there were, you know, in the last ice age, there were saber-toothed cats and other, you know, prehistoric animals walking around on that same soil. And it takes millennia for that soil to develop. It's rich in biotic material. It is like 2 feet deep into the ground, from what I understand. And when the heavy machinery comes out and drives over it, I know that that's not coming back for millennia. That's done. It's toast.
I have one more kind of trivial question before we move on, which is, like I said, I lived in northeastern Nevada for a couple of years, but I never really thought about this. How fast, you know, sagebrush is a dominant species up in the northeastern Nevada. And how fast does sagebrush grow? So if they take out sagebrush and then the sagebrush starts to recover, and then 30 years later, is it going to be a fairly big bush, or because it's so dry, is it going to be just a tiny little thing still? I know the sagebrush can live to be hundreds of years.
That's a great question. I think that your guess is probably right. I mean, I know I'm not as familiar with sagebrush because there isn't anywhere I live, but with the Mojave Yucca, and there's a lot of it out here, those are hundreds of years old. So when they grow back, I think someone showed me at the FEMA dome where the where 1 million Joshua trees were burnt last year. It's horrendous. There are little signs of, you know, little plants growing up in the soil around the dead trees, little Joshua trees, you know, the very small things coming out of the ground. So, you know, I would say that they don't get enormous anyway. So maybe over 300 years or 200 years, their growth rate isn't enormous. But so I don't know, you know, maybe it's in a matter of years could be a third or a quarter of the size of its full size. But I don't know. Yeah.
So let's move from let's move to some of the other modern threats to the region. And actually, before we go to solar, water pipelines bug me and nobody talks about them enough. And I just saw a really stupid thing on Bill Maher maybe a month ago about how important water pipes are. But can you talk about the harm caused by water pipes, and then we'll move on to solar?
Yeah, I know for a fact that, you know, if you take an environmental science class, they will tell you that Nevada, Arizona, this area, the southwest of the United States really, was not meant to have as many people as we have here, obviously. And it was a wetter time in the last, you know, maybe 100 years ago, the last century. It was a wetter time even for this region. So it kind of falsely gave an idea of how much water would be here in the first place. And we've grown beyond what we probably even expected with those numbers. And we're continuing to grow. And so the idea for the Southern Nevada Water Authority wanted to build a pipeline from eastern Nevada up by Great Basin National Park, where there's more groundwater because they haven't drained it all. And they wanted to, you know, pipe that water 300 miles south to Las Vegas. You know, Lake Mead is drying up. They declared a water emergency, the federal government did this summer. And so they're going to start reapportioning how the water is used at the Colorado River. And a lot of it's used for agriculture too. That's, I think, the most of it is used for that, actually. So that's where a lot of room for improvement is not using flood irrigation and using drip irrigation, things like this. But ultimately, the consequence of building that water pipeline would have been to suck the water, lower the water table. And, you know, the vegetation in the desert, that's one thing that people don't know, is it goes down into the ground to get that water. It goes down, you know, I wish I had an exact number, but it goes down very far. And, you know, that's where it gets the water from, is from the water table. So if the water table goes down, then there's a limit to where that vegetation can't get water anymore. And we saw this happen more so in, you know, Owens Valley, which is Paiute Hunahtu in the Paiute language, the Bishop Paiute tribe up there in that area can speak to this much more. But that lake was drained for water that went to LA. So we know what happens when you build these water pipelines or when you take water from an area to feed a city. I've been out there, and it's, you know, there's dust storms. It's like a dust bowl out there. You know, they try to spray chemicals down to keep the dust from blowing and stuff like that, which is, you know, fossil fuel and other chemicals, and, you know, obviously not good for the desert environment or for humans, but they do that anyways. But that's just, you know, that's really been harmful to that ecosystem. Obviously it destroyed the lake and the life that was there. And then it's harming the vegetation in the area as well. So that would happen. You have, obviously you have animals, you have, mule deer and elk and birds of prey, hawks and eagles, and your other garden variety animals like the kit fox, the coyote, which are more common. But, you know, all of the life in the Great Basin and in this transition zone to the Mojave would be affected by that water pipeline. There wouldn't be, you know, as much water available to them or plants for them to eat. And so, you know, you're looking at a huge area of eastern Nevada that would be dramatically harmed if not just destroyed. And one of the reasons why you had some resistance to that thing was because of the ranchers in that area. So there was an odd alliance between ranchers and indigenous people and anyone else that was that cared about that area, not just Las Vegas. The film I made in 2018, we basically followed indigenous people who came from different areas of the Southwest, and they ran from Great Basin National Park 300 miles down to Lake Mead. And that experience really changed my perspective about resources. You know, I knew it was a bad idea. I knew that we were growing too much, but the perspective of indigenous people just made me look at the earth differently too, to be honest. I always thought for pragmatic reasons we needed to make dramatic changes to our environmental resource management, but I think on a different level, like on a soul level, you know, I connected more with the land as a being after talking to indigenous people who talked about it that way. So that's been a perspective I've carried with me going forward as I've looked at these areas that are being destroyed by infrastructure and development. It's these places, it's, you know, there's individual plants and animal life there that are threatened. There's human pragmatic situations that are threatened, but, you know, ultimately it's, you know, it's more than that. A landscape is more than just those things. It's as a whole, it's a living thing.
What is the name of that film and how can people watch it?
It's Great Basin Water Protectors, and you can find it on YouTube or Vimeo. If you Google that name, you should find it. My name, Justin McAfee. I have a website, justinmcafee.com, and I actually have it posted on there in my About section as well.
Oh, so let's move on to your current film series called Desert Apocalypse. So can you talk about how that came to be and what's it about?
Yes. So I'm actually I decided to go after making that film in 2018. I decided that I wanted to do more of this and I wanted to get better at it because, you know, it's a nice film. It has a great story, but I wanted to up my game, so to speak. And so I went back to school in Nevada State College. They have a program for film, and I've invested in gear and things like that along the way as well. And just trying to be able to tell as good of a story as I can and have it appeal to people. And basically, you know, I was in 2018, I was down in that Walking Box Ranch area. It's one of my favorite areas. They have this enormous Joshua tree forest there. And it's just a place I go. It's kind of a sacred place. And I found out from a friend that they wanted to build a huge wind farm there. And we're talking about, you know, 600 foot tall windmills, wind turbines, about 100 of them. And because it is a hillside that has wind, you know. And, you know, I was all about, hey, we got to address climate change. But it seemed like that this is not the area to put this in. So I went to a town meeting in Searchlight where the locals were talking about it. And they were talking about the threat that the wind turbines were to, you know, eagles particularly, and other like bats and owls and all kinds of flying creatures particularly. But then, you know, you have to build 20 foot wide roads through this pristine desert, as pristine as it can be anyways. And it just appalled me, to be honest with you. And I started talking to people who were opposing it, including a man named Alan O'Neill, who was the superintendent at Lake Mead National Recreation Area. He's trying to make that whole area a national monument for, and he wants to name it Avikwame, which is, it's in the language of the Mojave people, it's Spirit Mountain, which is their creation story. So the mountain called Spirit Mountain right there in that area is where they believe their creation occurred. So I began working with him. We've been going out there and filming and talking about that. And along the way, I met Laura Cunningham and Kevin Emmerich from Basin and Range Watch. And they have a website, basinandrangewatch.org, where they talk about all the places that are threatened by, all these, not only renewable energy, but mining and any other threats to the Mojave Desert. And they go into the Great Basin to some degree, and they're all at the Thacker Pass talking about that. So, in the process, I really was educated about, this enormous area, these projects that keep popping up. They would pop up like every week, they would have a new one. Oh, this one, there's an application for a solar project. It's 4.5 square miles. Up here's an application for one that is, 16 square miles. 16 square miles of solar panels on untouched habitat. And I was like, this is not good for the environment. This is not good for climate change. This is wrong. It's reprehensible. And so, in that process of learning those things, I started thinking about this and, I met, Laura and Kevin out at the Yellow Pine Solar Project. They were having an event out there and I wanted to just meet them. And I had met them before, about maybe a couple of years before at a meeting, but I didn't really talk to them for long. So went out there and I had a nice conversation with them and I was like, this, I'm actually, a member of the Sierra Club locally. I'm on the board of the Southern Nevada group here. And, they were working on good projects and I was just involved. I had a friend that works for him and everything. But anyway, I was like, the Sierra Club's not doing anything about this. They're not opposing these projects. I need to get in, I need to connect with people who are. So I was like, I want to help Basin Range Watch. And I'm a film student, so I'm thinking I'll make my senior project making this film. And so at first it was, hey, I'll make a feature-length film about this. And then I thought, that's going to take over a year to produce a feature-length film. I mean, for some people, it takes like 3 years to make a documentary that's feature-length. So instead of doing that, I decided, or maybe even in addition to doing that, I decided that I would release segments of this story on YouTube, get this information out there to build whatever kind of movement that we can. And I don't know what kind of movement we're going to build, of course, but we're going to, do our best. And the Yellow Pine Project was, the Yellow Pine Solar is, that is a 4.5 square mile project. It's in the Pahrump Valley between Las Vegas and Pahrump, which is, it's a wonderful example of Mojave Desert habitat. I mean, it's in really great shape, as far as I know. It's untouched, mostly. There's, in this one project, so to give you an idea, it's a, 3,000 acres, 4.6 square mile project. There's 90,000 yuccas. And those yuccas can be up to 300 years old. And that's how many will be destroyed just in that one project alone. And in addition to that, the transmission lines that they're building and the substations are actually opening up the kind of ability to build five more of these large projects just in that one area. So now we're talking about 30 square miles. So it's 18,000 additional acres that will be in addition to this Yellow Pine Solar Project. And, one of the first things that we did went out there, they told me that they're going to be removing the tortoise. There's desert tortoise, which is an endangered species, and it's listed. We have an Endangered Species Act, and yet they're still allowed to build this project and these other five projects in that area, as long as they are able to translocate the tortoise. So they built a tortoise exclusion fence, which basically puts a barrier around the project. And so it keeps the tortoises that are in there in, and it keeps the tortoises that are outside of it out. And then they go in, they send in his biologist, and I feel bad for, how can you be a biologist and do this? Well, it turns out Laura Cunningham, who worked for Basin Range Watch, she used to do this. She used to work for the BLM. She was a biologist. So she knew exactly how it was working. And it's one of the reasons why she stopped working for the BLM. And so she described the process, how they go out there with these buckets and these long sticks, and they pull these desert tortoise out of their burrows. And they, you know, they count how many they move, and they estimate, oh, based on this many acreage, there's going to be these many tortoises there. But it's going to be grossly underestimating how many tortoises, because they don't move the juveniles, and they don't count the eggs as well. So, you know, they may say there's 500 desert tortoises in this one project, but there might be 1,000 or more. But what we do know is they actually tracked 139 of the tortoises, and 30 of them died, probably as a result of badgers, because there is a drought. And, you know, so the predators are out trying to eat whatever they can that's going to sustain them. And so here, these desert tortoises are just placed on the land, and they don't have their normal burrow to hide in to protect themselves. And so they get predated by, you know, coyote or badgers or other predators. So that's what we know for a fact.
I believe Laura also told me that a lot of these so-called translocated tortoises also try to make their way home and end up dying outside the fences.
Yeah, they pace up and down the fence line, which, you know, that makes them very vulnerable as well. You know, if they were like, if they knew what was happening and they could just go, oh, I just need to get to a new burrow real quick, then, you know, maybe that would be better. But they don't. They're trying to go home, and that's what they want to do.
Well, and I also at the same time don't blame them, because I love the land where I live, and if I were jerked out by some jerk from the BLM and taken away, and they put a fence around my home, I might pace back and forth too, trying to get home.
Totally agree. Totally agree.
Okay, so before we go on, who else lives there? There's desert tortoises. We got yucca. We got Joshua trees in that region too. I don't know. Who else calls those places home?
Yeah. So there is Joshua trees. There's a highway there called the Tecopa Road, and that's named after a Native American chief from years ago, a Southern Paiute chief. And for some reason, the Joshua trees don't grow on once you get over that road and you go towards Pahrump. And maybe that's because of the changes in the ecology or what. But so they basically have divided the area by that highway. So everything to the east of that highway with the Joshua trees are not going to touch that. They're just not building on it right now. And then everything to the west of that highway, there doesn't seem to be as many Joshua trees, but there is these large yucca, and you'll see them in the film. We try to show people what they look like. They're taller than I am, and I'm 6'3", some of them. And you have, you know, you have burrowing owls, you have kit fox, you have coyote, you have, there's bighorn sheep that, you know, they travel from mountain range to mountain range. I was driving right outside of Pahrump towards Death Valley, and you don't expect anything to run out in front of you like you do in the woods, probably where you live or where I grew up in Illinois. Like, deer will jump out in front of your car like that. Well, a bighorn sheep did that, and I was in the middle of a basin. So they, you know, they travel from range to range through the basin. And so, you know, it may not be where they sleep at night or their, you know, normal stomping grounds, but they definitely, it's connectivity. You know, that's how it works. There is, I don't know if I said badgers. There's Gila monsters. There is a whole host of birds and reptiles that, you know, I know that Laura and Kevin are much better at naming all of them if you ask them. But there, you know, there is night lizards and numerous different birds and, you know, obviously like snakes, rattlesnake, and eagle. There's many birds of prey. I see red-tailed hawks out there. There's golden eagles, bald eagles.
I'm going to ask you one more strange nature question, then we can go back to solar, which is, since it's so dry there, are there any amphibians at all? Any salamanders, any frogs, any toads?
I believe there are, but I think it's in certain areas. So when there is water.
Only in springs or something.
Right.
Okay, so we have this 4.5 mile. What is the current status of other solar facilities in the area, and what is the status of this particular 4.5 mile solar facility you're talking about?
So with this project, they already had the exclusion fence. They've already done some translocating. They say construction will begin. They probably have to remove more desert tortoise as the weather cools down. They're not allowed to do it when it's a certain temperature. So they have to wait till it cools down. They'll probably finish doing another few sweeps of that. And then I think this fall is when they plan to start constructing. And I think they'll do it in phases, but they're going to construct the solar panels. And, you know, there's like the, can't remember the name of it now. There's another solar project that's near Mesquite, Nevada, that is actually supposed to be the largest solar project in the country. And that one also has the fence up, but they haven't began construction yet. But then there's these other five in that area in the Prone Valley. They haven't even started putting up the exclusion fences yet. And to give you a broader idea of how much we're talking about here, they have opened up 9 million acres of Nevada to solar development. That's in the BLM's plan. There's a map that I show on the, in the film that shows this, you know, pink areas and blue areas where they're allowing solar and wind development to be applied for. So they have to, there's some of it that's considered solar zones. And so the application process will be simpler. And then there's this other process. It's like a variant. They have to do a variance application. And so they have to mitigate and things like that. So those are the two different kinds of applications that they're going to do. But essentially, we could be looking at, you know, 9 million acres of solar panels and wind across Nevada. Our second episode, we talked about this area near Tonopah that is 100 square miles. It's like six different solar projects, 100 square miles, just for those six projects. You know, and this is just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, this is happening rapidly. It's being fast-tracked. The BLM's comments, they didn't even really have like a public meeting. They had a Zoom meeting where they gave a presentation and they allowed people to like type in questions and they answered them. And the answers were like, I would say just basically just, they were completely biased. I mean, it was like, so rooftop solar doesn't work. You know, we need utility scale solar, and, you know, and they gave these reasons why. And then our third episode that's coming out, actually, by the time you hear this, will already have come out. It's about the Sawtooth Solar Project. This is adjacent Death Valley National Park. It's 16 square miles. There's 70,000 Joshua trees in that project that would be destroyed. And you've probably seen, I think they're called like bush hogs or something, that they come in and they just basically turn a yucca tree or a Joshua tree into sawdust. That's what they're going to do. They're not going to translocate the Joshua trees. That's the Western Joshua tree. It's California called it endangered, but it doesn't have any kind of protection like that in Nevada. And then there's, you know, our fourth episode is going to be about an area also next to Death Valley, near Rhyolite, which is an old ghost town. And there's another 15 square miles there. I made a video where we just drove through this area at 50 miles per hour. And, you know, the video lasts like 5 or 6 minutes. And, you know, we're just going on and on and on. I just cannot fathom solar panels filling that entire area. And you, that area is, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just saying that area is full of, you know, the same kinds of plants, creosote and other, you know, biology that's there that's all threatened as well.
Just to emphasize this, can you say these areas again? Like the yellow pine is 4.5 square miles, plus there's an additional, just go through. I want people to really listen to the numbers because that's really horrifying. So just go through this many square miles, this many square miles, this many acres. Go through these projects again, please.
Yeah. And so, you know, again, 9 million acres opened up to Nevada. I won't be able to, in my lifetime, talk about all of the areas that will be threatened. But just in the time I have been making films about it and have had the time to do so, we're talking about the Yellow Pine Solar Project, which is 4.6 square miles, 3,000 acres. There's an additional 18,000 acres or 30 square miles of project, solar projects just in the Pahrump Valley. And then we go on to Tonopah. There is a 100 square mile, there's six applications, six projects that they divide this up into, but it's about 100 square miles of solar just west of Tonopah. There is the Sawtooth Solar Project, which is 16 square miles. That's in the Sarcobetas Flats, right next to Death Valley, north of Beatty. And then south of Beatty is the other area, near Rhyolite, and that's 15 square miles of solar. So we're talking, you know, that's 100. I've just talked about 160 square miles of solar projects in just the last few months that I've been able to get out and actually put a camera on. And the projects are just, you know, they're coming in faster than we can keep up with them. There's Highway 50 that goes across Nevada from east to west. It's called the loneliest highway in America. That's going to be full of these projects, including wind as well. And you're talking about, that's one of the things I think that's worth mentioning is Nevada is passing, they passed a law this session creating a, what's called the Greenlink Transmission Network. And this will have these enormous transmission lines go from Reno to Las Vegas along the border of Nevada, cut across the state to go over to Ely, and then come down the I-15 to Las Vegas as well. So making this huge triangle to allow, because this couldn't happen without transmission. So these transmission lines are the means by which they're opening up. And we can see basically every basin from Reno to Las Vegas full of solar panels. That's, if you want to put it in terms that people can see, just imagine that. And that's what they're doing because they, I think they know that just to electrify the grid, they're going to have tons of solar panels. And that's just going to electrify the grid. We're not, that's, as you like to say, it's like 20% of all energy we use. And they're talking about electrifying transportation as well, but they're only talking about it. They're not mandating any of this stuff. It's just, but that's what they want to try to do. And really, they want connectivity between California and Nevada and other states as well. So they're, this is just the beginning. I mean, this is the tip of the iceberg. There's, I think there's 24 million acres in the American West that the BLM has basically green lighted for solar. So that's why I call it a desert apocalypse, because no joke, this is, I mean, I think the whole world is heading towards apocalypse if we want to be real about it, but definitely, I mean, immediately right now, this is the front line. Nevada is the front line for this apocalypse. We have all kinds of endangered species and rare species of plants and fish and other animals that I don't even really know all of them. There's like teams buckwheat, and there's all these dade fish that are in little springs and stuff. But, you know, beyond that, there's the desert tortoise and the sage grouse and many others that are threatened by all of this.
So we go ahead.
Yeah. So, you know, that's why I say this is the front line, because, you know, you have Thacker Pass up there in northern Nevada where they're wanting to build a 1,000 acre open pit mine for lithium. And near where we were looking at the solar panels developments in Tonopah, that's a huge, that's like the largest lithium mine currently in the United States. And there's a mountain range called the Monte Cristo Range that's in that area that they want to open up for lithium as well. And so we have not only the renewable energy stuff, we have this huge mining boom. I mean, it's a mining revolution. It's like nothing we've ever seen before. And mining has already been horrible for the environment. I'm sure anyone that knows anything about it knows that. Now we're talking about copper, cobalt, and, you know, obviously lithium and many other minerals they want to mine to be able to do all of this.
So I'm one of the things I'm kind of known for is for talking about how this culture will kill everything it can before it collapses. And one of the, it's not like I was born, you know, just, it's not like that was clear to me when I was 10 years old. That the reason that has become clear to me is the story you're telling here, where, you know, it's like they tried to destroy the place. They would argue that they were developing natural resources, but this is in effect what happened through mining. And the place survived that. And then there was the cattle ranching, and it somehow survived that. And now they're going to throw in the solar. And it's like, how many times do they, think they can destroy the planet before it actually dies? And again, you don't have to go, this is my thing, but it's just, it's just so clear that there is one threat, and then they move on to make an even worse threat, and then they work on, oh yeah, we forgot the radioactive bombing. And what does it mean when a bombing range is probably in better shape than the surrounding area? Anyway, so, yeah, I'm supposed to be the interviewer and not go on rants myself, but that just, the numbers you're giving me are just making me so angry.
It's really astonishing. I mean, that's why I started doing this, because I really couldn't believe it. And what's really astonishing to me, and that's why I'm trying to talk about it more, is that I don't think people understand. In fact, the reaction online from forums where environmentalists are is pretty vitriolic. It's like, yeah, but imagine how bad it'll be for those environments with climate change. And I get that argument. I think that fear has been drilled into people so much that, hey, climate change is going to wipe out that stuff anyway, so we can save the rest of it by wiping that out. And they call it breaking eggs to make an omelet, you know. One thing I didn't talk about is like the carbon sequestration in that damn soil out there. I mean, they say it's one of the best carbon suckers in the whole United States is this area, because it's so vast and it's untouched and it's absorbing carbon every year. And going out there and destroying all of that is just releasing a carbon bomb. I just think there's no carbon. There's no accurate carbon accounting. It's all smoke and mirrors.
Well, add to this Jevons paradox, where the more energy that is produced, the more energy people use. So it actually, I mean, this has been shown time and again that solar and wind, et cetera, effectively do not displace oil. They add on top of oil. So all this is destroying it to make more energy so people can have more, so industry can have more, I don't know, retractable stadium roofs and whatever, you know, aluminum factories and bauxite smelters, and can make more stuff.
The Ponzi scheme.
Yeah, it's a Ponzi scheme. And another point that I want to make here, you said that you got to crack some eggs to make some omelets, but you'll notice whose eggs are being destroyed. It's the desert tortoise eggs that are being destroyed. It's not the industrial manufacturing eggs being destroyed. Every single time, it's nature has to take this up. I saw a headline in the LA Times a few years about, oh gosh, what's the name of the famous solar facility in Nevada that has the central tower?
Well, there's Ivanpah.
Ivanpah, that's the one.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. So about that, back when it was being constructed, there was an article in the LA Times headlined, destroying the desert to save the environment. And that's just nuts. That's just, anyways, I mean, that's exactly the argument they're making. We need to destroy the desert to supposedly save the environment, but that's not what's happening. And yeah, I don't think desert tortoises would agree anyway.
Exactly.
Anyway, sorry, you were going to say something before I ranted again.
No, that's okay. Yeah, I mean, I looking at that differently is that these things have rights that we don't recognize, you know, and they have value. They obviously have value. I mean, when we destroy biodiversity, we're killing ourselves. And that's one thing that I've been trying to say as well, that, hey, the scientists are saying that the biodiversity crisis is a co-equal threat to climate change, as climate changes to humanity. That is something that they're completely in denial. Like, you know, they talk about climate change denialism, like they're, you know, kind of this holier than thou attitude that they have about people who doubt climate change, but they are just as guilty. Many of these environmentalists are just as guilty of being denialists of the biological diversity crisis. And that's putting it in the terms that is predominantly used in science. You know, the UN said we need to rewild an area the size of China if we want to have any hope of surviving. And they're not, you know, then they just did this dog and pony show of, yes, we're going, you know, the guy who owns Amazon, Jeff Bezos, has said he's going to help get 30 by 30, you know, and then you look closer at the details of all of this and you see that it's a dog and pony show. It's smoke and mirrors. They're not genuine about it. And that's because, you know, I've learned through all this process that it's, you know, the people who are making money on destroying the planet aren't going to stop doing that voluntarily. It's just not going to happen. And so, like any other change that we've ever had in the history of humanity, you need radicals leading the charge to make this happen. Otherwise, it's just not going to happen. And so, you know, those are the kinds of messaging I'm trying to discuss on a larger platform, you know, to get people thinking about it. And I think it's definitely working with some people, but there's definitely a lot of resistance to it.
So we have just a couple minutes left. Can you tell people the names of your films, how they can watch them, and also how people anywhere in the United States, or especially Nevada, but anywhere in the United States, can get involved to help shut down these projects? So first off,
thank you, Derek.
Your films, and then second, what can people do to get involved?
You bet. So the first film was The Great Basin Water Protectors. You can find that, you know, on YouTube or on my website, justinmackey.com. The series that I'm working on right now is called Desert Apocalypse, and they're featured each episode. There's three now. There should be four soon. They're featured on desertapocalypse.com. If you go to the website there, I have the videos embedded. You know, obviously we accept donations because we're buying gear. We're filling up 8 terabyte hard drives in the process because we're using cinema cameras, and we're traveling. And there's I'm just putting the bill for this myself, and I've had some support from people, so it's been great. BasinAndRangeWatch.org is the website that my partner group that I'm working with. You know, Laura Cunningham and Kevin Emmerich are biologists. They are the science of this. So I'm bringing in the experts, and they do great work. I mean, they are on top of all of these projects. They're posting on their social media and website, and they're talking about this when no other environmental organizations in the area are really talking about this. I mean, they're making, some of them will go make comments at the BLM things, but they won't oppose them, and they don't talk about them publicly. So, you know, Basin and Range Watch is a great organization to support, and they're helping me. So we appreciate it.
Okay. Is there anything else you want to say before we close down? Anything else you want people to know about the desert?
The desert is not a wasteland. We hear that all the time. People say, well, it's just, you know, it's a wasteland out there. It is full of life. I've fallen in love with it. I grew up in the forests of Southern Illinois, where there's rivers and these huge forests. But out here, it's just, it's a smaller scale of forest. Like, the trees aren't as tall. But I consider the creosote ranges to be a forest. You walk out in them and they're teeming with life. And that's how all of these deserts are out here. It's deceptive. They're not wastelands. I mean, there are some sand dunes out there, but even in the sand dunes, there's life. And even on the playas, there's life. There's food for the birds. There these, you know, brine shrimp. But anyway, the main thing is I love the desert. It's worth saving. We absolutely need it for humanity and for the future of the planet. So we need to fight for it.
Well, thank you so much for all of that. And thank you for your work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Justin McAfee. Justin McAfee. I'm so sorry to mispronounce your name. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.